Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Some lost their jobs or homes, others' lives were threatened. But with their children attending inferior schools, the families involved in the 1954 landmark Brown versus the Board of Education case stood firm and changed the nation. We revisit the Brown case this week with our guest, James J. Patterson. Following that, for our commentary of the week, Mark Bauerlein offers us his thoughts on one of the best-known yet controversial figures in African-American history, Booker T. Washington. But first, Dan Roberts tells us about another small step forward in ending segregation in America, in this case, a figure well-known to us in an incident far less well-known.
On a summer evening in 1944 during World War II, at Camp Hood near Waco, Texas, Lieutenant Jackie Robinson struck a blow for freedom by refusing to go to the back of the bus.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
As much as the denial of political rights, petty segregation, such as separate accommodations, restricted bathrooms, having to sit at the back of the bus, posed during most of the 20th century a constant reminder to African Americans of their second-class citizenship. While on active duty in the United States Army during World War II, future Brooklyn Dodger star Jackie Robinson struck a small blow for equality. Post rules at Camp Hood stated that there would be no segregation on the buses that carried people around the base. On a summer night in 1944, Robinson and the light-skinned wife of one of his friends were riding about halfway back on a post bus. Robinson suddenly realized that the bus had stopped and the driver was shouting at him to go to the back of the bus. As recalled by biographer Bill Roeder, Robinson thought the driver might have been irritated because of the girl thinking she was white. He refused to move. MPs came and escorted him to the base provost marshal. The lieutenant was within his full rights, but in the world of petty segregation, Jackie Robinson could not expect fair treatment. He had to fight for it. He might have been forgotten, but fellow officers at Hood came to his aid, alerted the NAACP, and it put pressure on authorities at the base. Robinson was court-martialed on reduced charges and acquitted. For millions of African Americans, manipulated by petty segregation, the hard-won victories of people like Jackie Robinson were an inspiration, but significant relief for them was a generation away. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Rarely does an elementary school become a national landmark, but this month, an elementary school in Topeka, Kansas, that played a key role in the U.S. Supreme Court case that outlawed segregation was dedicated as a memorial to that legal struggle. The case, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, began in 1951 as a federal class action lawsuit. It ended in May 1954, 50 years ago this month, when the Supreme Court handed down its ruling. Talking History's Jim Madison takes another look at the Brown case with his guest, James T. Patterson.
50 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down what may be the most important decision of the 20th century. Brown v. Board of Education declared in May 1954 that separate education facilities are inherently unequal. Separate but equal would no longer be the law of the land. To explain this historic event and its 50-year aftermath, we have James T. Patterson, history professor at Brown University, and the author of Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy, published recently by Oxford University Press. We're talking with Professor Patterson today from his Providence, Rhode Island office. Welcome, Jim Patterson.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin by setting the stage for this decision. What was America like in 1954, especially when it came to issues of race?
Well, it was, of course, the Jim Crow era of segregation in the South and in the border states and in some other states. It separated blacks and whites in those states by law, as opposed to the de facto segregation which often existed elsewhere. In all of these states, for instance, with regard to schools, which is what the Brown case concerned, of course, there were 17 states that required the racial separation and segregation of black and white students, and four other states, including Kansas, which is where the Brown case came from, which permitted local areas in the state to impose it. This affected millions of children and was the anchor, really, of the much larger Jim Crow segregation system, which affected not only schools but everything else, public accommodations, restaurants, hotels, even drinking fountains and telephone booths. So it was a very harsh system of separation, which also carried with it discrimination, which is to say the separate but equal facilities were separate but unequal.
And that would certainly apply to schools.
Unequal.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. In the South, for instance, in the 11 states of the old Confederacy, it was estimated in the early 50s, when this litigation was reaching the Supreme Court, that the black schools in the South received about 60% as much per pupil as the white schools did. And I should point out that the white schools in the South generally were much poorer than the schools outside of the South. So these were very, very poor schools, often without central heating, leaky roofs, tar paper roofs, wood stoves, poorly educated teachers, very dated hand-me-down textbooks, and so forth, and very crowded facilities. It was very difficult to get any kind of a decent education in most of those schools. And in my book, I'm not very nostalgic about these places.
Right. You said earlier that these schools were really the anchor of a much larger system. Can you elaborate on that? And is that some of the reason why the civil rights movement or the NAACP decided to focus on schools?
They focused on schools. Originally, they focused in the 1930s and 40s on graduate schools, which they correctly understood were less sensitive, since this was not involving young children. But in the late 40s and early 50s, they switched from a strategy of demanding equality, that is to say, demanding equal within a separate system, to a challenge on segregation itself. That decision was made by the NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund, which was its litigating arm, in 1950, and it took another 4 years before the Supreme Court reached a decision. The schools were always the most sensitive area of race relations. The civil rights movement later on made wonderful strides in wiping out segregation and Jim Crow and discrimination in, for instance, public accommodations, voting, things of that sort. But resistance to school desegregation from the beginning up until the present day has been powerful in the South.
Why was that so?
I think it's mainly because parents, black parents as well as white parents, but here we're talking about the resistance of white parents, understandably care about their children and their children's education above practically all other things. And as we know, people move to places, if they can afford it, where they anticipate that their kids are going to get a good education. So faced with the thought or the danger, as many whites saw it, of black kids joining their own kids in desegregated schools, many white parents thought that their children's education would suffer. And behind that, there was always the deep fear of social interaction, dating, interracial sex, marriage, and so forth, which was something that young children, teenagers in particular, of course, would be in danger of getting involved in. So it was a lot easier for whites, when forced by the civil rights legislation of the 60s, to accept eating in the same restaurant or staying in the same hotel or waiting in the same line in a public building or going into a swimming pool or a beach or a park or voting or getting on a bus, as was the fight in Montgomery with Martin Luther King in 55, 56. All of these things were contested, but not nearly so strongly or so lastingly as desegregation of the schools.
Right. One of the main characters in your book, Brown v. Board of Education, is Thurgood Marshall, a name familiar certainly to older Americans. But can you introduce him to us and tell him why he's such an important figure here?
Yes, Marshall was raised in Baltimore and of what would then have been considered a middle-class black family. His mother was a school teacher. His father was a steward and a waiter in an all-white club. So he had a little better start in life than the vast majority of blacks who matured in the 1920s. He went to a black university and then tried or thought of going to the University of Maryland Law School. But, of course, it was segregated. He couldn't get in, so he went to the Howard Law School in Washington, D.C., which it turned out was a major trainer of some of the leading black attorneys of the 1930s and 40s. And he got out of law school in the early 30s and immediately joined the NAACP and later headed the Legal Defense Fund in the late 30s. and was known as Mr. Civil Rights by the late 1940s because of all of his efforts on behalf of fighting discrimination, not just schools. They had a lot of cases involving military service and rape and criminal cases, but increasingly the school issue became the most important one by the late 40s.
And just to look ahead quickly here, he does go on, of course, to a national career in a different venue later on.
Oh, yeah. He's, of course, the first black Supreme Court justice appointed by Lyndon Johnson in 1967, and he served until 1991, I can't remember which, and his place as, quote, the black justice was then taken by Clarence Thomas.
Right. Something that is his appointment in 67, something that would have been unimaginable in 1954, I assume.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. You're quite right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this decision that we call Brown v. Board of Education. What was it? Just a summary of it, please.
Well, it was actually five cases. There were five cases that came up through the courts, the best known of which is the Brown case, named after Oliver Brown, the father of Linda Brown, a black third grader, who was segregated in the Topeka elementary schools. And it was, as I say, it had a long and characteristically long course of getting to the Supreme Court, which actually heard argument. It's on it twice. And as you said earlier, the decision was finally made in May of 1954. And what it said was that state-sponsored segregation of schools was unconstitutional. And the assumption, therefore, was that down the road they would be desegregated. The court, however, was very, very sensitive to the anticipated Southern white resistance. And they did not say anything in the 1954 decision as to how or when this desegregation process would be carried out. They waited another year, heard more arguments about it, and made a decision in May of 1955, which said that desegregation should be carried out, this famous phrase, with all deliberate speed. And this is one of the most confusing and really unhelpful phrases in the history of the Supreme Court, because speed, of course, means rapidly, deliberate means with deliberation, take your time. And in any event, the South did take its time and fiercely resisted the Brown versus Board decisions. The first one's usually called Brown Rule Number 1, and the second one Brown Rule Number 2 in 1955. And it wasn't until the very late 60s and early 70s that teeth was finally put into this decision, and some desegregation took place in these southern states. In fact, in May of 1964, 10 years after the original decision, only about 1% of black public school students, the decision covered only public schools, in the South, in the 11 states of the old Confederacy, were going to school with whites.
So clearly the deliberate word is more important than the speed word in that.
In terms of what happened, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell us more about that reaction, that resistance from white Americans, white Southerners in particular?
Well, it ranged the gamut from violence. There were some violent responses, although when you think of the extent of the opposition, the violence was rather minor. But there were all kinds of other ways of getting around the decision, which we really haven't time to talk about. But essentially, they would have, well, one favorite tactic was pupil placement laws. Education in this country was, and even now, is pretty much of a local phenomenon, supported by local tax dollars and operated, administered through local school districts. And what these local people would do, in the South, for instance, and in some of the border states, is decide that after Brown to place students according to various academic or psychological categories, which they developed, all of which miraculously had the effect of placing all the whites in some schools and all the blacks in the other schools. And when challenged about this, they would say, we're not doing this racially. This is just the way the ball drops.
Right, right.
And they got away with this. That was just one of the many ruses until, as I say, the court finally clamped down on these. And another message was freedom of choice plans, where the school district would say to the parents, you're free to go wherever you want. But very few black parents dared send their kids into the all-white schools in most places.
Right.
And so the freedom of choice plans really didn't accomplish anything.
What about the president at the time, Dwight Eisenhower? Just briefly, what was his reaction to Brown v. Board of Education?
Eisenhower was, I think, a principled conservative on most matters, including race relations, if you can be principled and resist rapid desegregation as he did. He really believed that the only way race relations were going to improve and that segregation would be done away with would be in the long spread of time as local people became more tolerant and worked things out. He, like many conservatives, he did not believe that government, particularly the federal government, should be imposing these decisions.
Did he use the White House bully pulpit, however?
Not really, no. He did desegregate some government facilities, such as veterans hospitals and the sort, and tried to get the District of Columbia schools to desegregate. But he, no, he didn't. He never endorsed the Brown decision. He said the Supreme Court has made its decision, and because that's now the law of the land, I will support it. But he never used the bully pulpit. The closest you could say that he came to doing that was in Little Rock crisis of 1957. And here he did finally send federal troops into Little Rock in order to desegregate Central High School. But he did so belatedly, very reluctantly, and on the grounds that his commander-in-chief, the resistance that the state of Arkansas and the city of Little Rock had undertaken to prevent desegregation in 1957 was a direct challenge to the federal authority.
Yes.
But he never justified it on the grounds that segregation was immoral or wise, or that desegregation was wise.
In just the few seconds we have left, Jim, can you answer a tough question 50 years later? Is America better because of Brown?
Well, it's certainly better, much better, because of the desegregation which followed in the wake of Brown. Yes, I think so. You find a lot of people today, including a number of black people, who feel that desegregation of schools has not accomplished much, and many black parents would prefer to send their, it's a minority, but some would prefer to send their kids to predominantly black schools run by predominantly black educators. But in a general way, the constitutional doctrine of desegregation, which began in an important way with the Brown decision in 1954, was then extended to desegregation of all ways and manners of life. And
yes.
That's got to be a great improvement.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. James Patterson, Brown University, talking about his book, Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy, published by Oxford University Press. Thank you, Jim.
Many thanks.
Not all advances in ending discrimination against African Americans were as dramatic as those of Jackie Robinson in the Brown case. Some were much more gradual and involved compromise. Booker T. Washington took such an approach and became one of the most highly regarded African Americans of his day. But Washington was not without his detractors, then and now. Mark Bauerlein examines what he titles The Tactical Life of Booker T. Washington.
100 years ago, who was the most famous person in the United States? Teddy Roosevelt, maybe, but a close second ran an unlikely figure, a man born in slavery, reared in Jim Crow, and running a small school in rural Alabama, Booker T. Washington. Life in the South for a black man in 1900 was hard and humiliating. The only jobs lay at the bottom, hauling freight and picking cotton. Race hatred was always a risk, and the lynching craze could erupt without warning. But there was Washington in the White House dining with the president, receiving an honorary degree from Harvard, writing best-selling books about his life. Wherever he went, reporters clustered to catch his thoughts on the latest events. He was a man of forceful character, driven by a relentless Protestant work ethic. Early in his life, he took a tactical approach to race relations. African Americans, newly freed from slavery, he reasoned, have little chance of achieving equality until they acquire the basics of middle-class life. Progress comes from a steady job, a bank account, a piece of property, not protest and voting drives. Southern whites mistrust you. But don't fight back, he counseled. Work hard, save money, spend wisely, and pay taxes. The higher attainments of culture and citizenship shall wait until blacks master the lower traits of thrift and industry. The message struck. Washington announced it in a legendary speech in Atlanta in 1895, the so-called Atlanta Compromise. There, he maintained, the wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly. Instead, black men should form a bloc of reliable workers that will enhance business and industrial prosperity in the South. Let the whites have their racism. Just give us an honest wage and a decent chance, he asked. All this with the thundering oratory of a man on a mission. A reporter noted, his eyes and his whole face lit up with the fire of prophecy. The governor of Georgia rushed to shake his hands. It was a revolutionary moment, a black man declaring a new social economic policy for the South. From then on, he became leader of his race, the Wizard of Tuskegee. With the prestige, though, came enemies. Rabid whites believed that Washington's program meant the eventual breakdown of race hierarchy. Maybe they were right, but black militants, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, thought that the agenda moved too slowly and required too much compromise and indignity. True, Washington condemned lynching, but he also agreed that many black men have criminal tendencies and must be stopped. He supported the vote, but advised black men not to exercise it if it meant angering their white neighbors. If this was progress, Du Bois and others concluded, better to fail and keep your pride. As his power grew, he planted spies in rival circles, got jobs for loyalists and blackballed critics. But don't judge him too quickly. He was at the center of the flaming issue of the day, his every opinion scrutinized. The pressure was ceaseless. He followed one principle, don't demand political rights until you have the economic power to back it up, and crafted a delicate peace with a racist society. Canny and complex, Washington puts our historiography to the test. He was politically compromised and morally mixed, but in his stratagems and successes, we grasp the fractious course of race relations then and now in America.
You've been listening to Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University and the author of Negrophobia, A Race Riot in Atlanta, 1906. This is Talking History.
In the spring of 61, I kissed my mother goodbye. I put on a blue uniform and I fought for Lincoln's side. Until I got caught by Johnny Reb in the woods near Chapel Hill. And I wish God he'd have killed me then, but he sent me to Andersonville.
And finally, we continue with our reading of parts of the unpublished Civil War diary of Edwin R. Wilmarth, Union soldier in the 40th Massachusetts Infantry. The diary begins in May 1864. Wilmarth, who was fighting in Virginia, has been captured and imprisoned, first in Petersburg and then further south. On June 1st, he entered the infamous Andersonville prison in Georgia. On June 5th, he recorded this description of his new home.
The bellies of the Yankees starving in Andersonville.
Andersonville prison contains 16 acres, 5 of which is low and marshy, upon which no one can live or hardly walk across without miring into the deep mud, making 7 acres for the prisoners to occupy. At this time, there are 18,000 men in the stockade. There's no room to spare. Around the prison is what is called the stockade. It's simply pine logs 15 feet high. Inside, 20 feet from the stockade, is a strip of board nailed into posts about 4 feet high. It's called the deadline. Rebel guards in sentry boxes stand with muskets brought to bear on the inside of the camp, and should anyone venture to cross the deadline, their first warning would be a bullet through him, or so close as to put him in mind he's in some place where he has no business to be. Water is used from the brook for drinking, washing, bathing, and cooking, but we get no soap. It seems to be an endless task to erase the black pine smoke from our faces and hands. But we go through the motion, and by the aid of a little sand can start it a little. The water is none of the best for drinking purposes, as the cookhouse stands on the head of a stream. As they boil their tainted bacon, they manage some way to get plenty of grease into the water, which looks very pretty as it floats in the surface. We're getting now our pint of meal and about 2 ounces of bacon, barely enough to grease the plate on which to cook our hoe cakes. The rations came in on the team, which brings in a load of meal, and in returning stops at the deadhouse, takes in a load of gone heroes, and carries them to the plantation where they're buried, and from there to the commissaries, where they take in a load of edibles and return to the prison. This saving much valuable time, very essential to them, but very disgusting to us. I'll write more some other day. My time is now to be devoted to draining my hovel. Next time, Wilmarth continues his observations on life in Andersonville Prison. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Born by a river, but it was paved with cement. I was born by a river, but it was paved with cement. Still I'd stand in that dry river and dream that I was soaking wet. Someday it's gonna rain, someday it's gonna pour, someday that old dry river, Lord, it won't be dry anymore.